Jeff Perry, welcome to Australia. I believe this is your second visit to this country.
Yes, I came at the invitation of the Astronautical Society of Western Australia in 1979 to take part in the convention at the Riverside Hotel. I read two papers, one on the Kettering Group and one on the Soviet space program.
Could you tell us briefly how you got interested in astronautics?
I always wanted to be a school teacher. I had a cousin as a school teacher, an aunt as a school teacher, and I was just told I was going to be a school teacher. And I wanted to be a science teacher. So when I went to the university, there was no shadow of doubt I was going to become a physics teacher. And I'd always believed in space travel, particularly from the time when in 1944 the V2 rockets fell near my home in Essex. In fact, this first use of space, because these V2 rockets travelled through space on their way from Germany to my country, was a hostile use, a military use of space. And I realised that it would not be too long before we saw things actually in orbit, although I must confess I didn't expect them to come quite as soon as they did. When the first Sputnik was launched on October the 4th, 1957, I was quite prepared for it. I'd read all about the International Geophysical Year and quite expected that the Oxford and Cambridge scholarship questions would have something about that. So I'd made it my business to acquaint myself with the programmes that were planned. I was particularly fascinated with the American and Russian plans to launch artificial satellites. I didn't see Sputnik 1. I don't think anybody saw Sputnik 1. People saw its rocket. But the head of science at Kettering Grammar School, he did see the Sputnik 1 rocket on several occasions before it burned up. But by the time they launched Sputnik 2 with the dog in it, I was determined to see this thing, and I watched it slowly moving across the sky like a bright star. And early in 1958, I decided I would try and take a photograph of Sputnik 2, which I did by using a Zeiss Netar 2¼ square format camera. I clamped it to the bedroom windowsill. As the satellite went by, I opened the shutter for a time exposure of about 30 seconds. When I developed the film, I found I'd got a black mark across the negative, together with short images of the stars and the television aerial, which was attached to the garage. Also in 1958, I went to the Brussels World Exhibition and saw models of Sputnik 2 and Sputnik 1. And that year, the Russians launched Sputnik 3. This was another large satellite, a geophysical laboratory, and I watched that and its rocket based on predictions which were published in the Daily Telegraph.
Jeff, you have achieved fame as the founder of the Kettering Group and are now considered the Western world's leading authority on the Soviet space effort. How did this all come about?
I suppose the start of the Kettering Group, as people come to know it now, also was triggered in 1958 by the death of the chemistry teacher. When his replacement was appointed in 1959, he was a radio amateur, G3FOZ, or Derek Slater, and I realised that here was someone with the equipment which would let me hear the things that I'd been watching. We decided that we would try and pick up signals from the next Russian satellite to be launched. I'd heard a recording of Sputnik 1 at a science masters meeting in London, and I'd been impressed by the Doppler shift, the way in which the frequency changed, went from a high note to a low note as the satellite went by. And I determined to get a recording of this to use in my own teaching in the sixth form when we came to the Doppler effect. The only trouble for us was that the Russians didn't launch any satellites in 1959. They had three attempts shooting at the moon. The first time they missed it, the second time they hit it, the third time they went round the back, photographed the hidden side and transmitted the first picture of the far side back to Earth. And then in May 1960, we heard on the radio that the Russians had launched the fourth satellite, Sputnik 4. And I can remember this must have been on a Saturday, because on the Sunday I went to Derek's and said, I think we should try and get this one. What do we need? He said, well, I've got the radio, we need a beat frequency oscillator. I can borrow that from Cyril Dobson, who was G3ICK. He said, and you've got a tape recorder. That's really all we need. When's it coming? I said, well, hold your breath. It's not coming until 4 o'clock tomorrow morning. So despite that, we decided that we would get up and make a try for here in Sputnik 4. We were lucky at the first attempt. I was outside trying to see it. Derek opened the window and said, I've got the signal. I dashed inside. I didn't think any more about looking for it. In any case, it was a bit cloudy. And we got this recording. We made several more recordings during that week. At the end of the week we got the recording which you've just heard, and we decided that that would be enough, and so we put the radio away. In the summer of 1960, the Americans launched a big satellite, a balloon satellite which inflated in orbit, called Echo 1. It was 100 feet in diameter, and this was a very bright object moving slowly across the sky, and I made visual observations of this, again based on predictions in the paper. I also realised that there was data hidden in those predictions, and by plotting the times of the predicted passes against the date, I could see that they were falling into a pattern, and from analysing the slopes of the graph, I was able, using theory published in Desmond King Healy's book Artificial Satellites for Scientific Research, to arrive at a value for the flattening of the Earth at the poles of about 1 over 298. Published this in a note to the School Science Review. In 1961, there was a conference for sixth form physics teachers at University College in London, which I attended. Coincidentally, this coincided with an exhibition at Earl's Court of Soviet Union, in which they showed some of their spacecraft. And while I was at that conference, I discovered that there was an organisation called the Radio and Space Research Station, situated at Ditton Park near Slough, which produced predictions for amateur observers of artificial satellites, who could then send in their observations for analysis to produce better orbits and information about upper atmosphere winds and perturbations in the Earth's gravitational field. These observations are done by using binoculars or even naked eye and noting the exact time at which a satellite passes the line drawn between two stars, estimating a fraction of the distance from one star to the other, converting this into right ascension and declination, and putting all the results together into a computer to improve the orbit on which the prediction was based. In the autumn half term of 1961, the predictions said that an American satellite called Discoverer 32 was transmitting on a frequency close to 20 megahertz. This was because it had a pickerback satellite attached to it called Nora Alice 2, an ionosphere beacon built by George Svensson at the University of Illinois. So not going away for half term, I said to Derek, it might be an idea to pick this one up. So we got the apparatus out again and made recordings of the signals night and morning as it passed over Kettering going north and south, and we did that for a period of 2 weeks until the satellite burned up in the atmosphere. By analysing the curves that we were obtaining to get the time of closest approach to Kettering, dividing the difference in time between passes on consecutive days by 16, the number of orbits per day, we were able to determine the orbital period and see how it decreased towards the end, and plot a graph showing how the curve dropped slowly to begin with and then accelerated at the point of burn-up. an interesting feature early on in this graph where the graph departed from a straight line in a sort of a zigzag, and we weren't sure in those early days whether it was due to us or due to the satellite. On reflection, it was probably due to us. So when Discoverer 36 was launched at the end of that year, we decided that although we couldn't spare the time to track it daily from the time it was launched, we would wait until the orbital period got down to the same sort of value where we had our zigzag, and we'd try and track that one again and see if we got the same effect. We did this in the January-February of 1962. This time, just as it reached the point where we wanted, the transmitter failed, although the satellite was still in orbit. As the two satellites were very similar, they were Agena rockets, I reasoned that it shouldn't be impossible to add our first graph onto the second one and predict the time at which this second satellite, Discoverer 36, would burn up. And we got the decay time, or the burn-up time, to within about a day. In March 1962, the Russians instigated the Cosmos program. This was a cover-all term, covering all their launches. We're now up to Cosmos 1790, or we were when I left the United Kingdom. And this word is used to disguise all sorts of military missions, failed interplanetary missions, tests of manned spacecraft in the testing phase. And we picked up the signals from the first Cosmos and again put the apparatus away. And then in May of 1962, I received a letter from a squadron leader at the Royal Air Force College at Henlow. He and his colleague had decided they would like to have a satellite monitoring project for the cadets, and they'd been to the Minitrack station at Winkfield to see the sort of equipment that was needed. They'd been appalled by the racks and racks of equipment that they had there, and decided that such a setup was way beyond their means. And as they were leaving, someone said to them, "Why don't you go and see the fellows at Kettering? They track satellites with backyard equipment." So we said yes, they could come, and decided that we'd better find a satellite that they could listen to as they were on their way to Rolls-Royce at Derby. We found Sputnik 5. And as we listened to the signal as it went by, we noticed that instead of the steady fall in frequency due to the Doppler shift, suddenly it rose abruptly and then fell abruptly, and rose abruptly and fell abruptly. And I was able to show that this was a square wave superimposed on the normal Doppler curve. And we reasoned that one bank of solar cells had failed, and that as the satellite rotated, the voltage dropped, causing a change in the transmitted frequency. We went on listening to this for the rest of that summer term, and then put the apparatus away for the summer holiday. During the summer holiday, in the bulletin for the visual observers, I noticed that somebody at Aberystwyth was actually also getting the radio signals from Sputnik 5, and on inquiries I found that it was coming from the University College of Wales at Aberystwyth. So in the autumn half term, when my wife and daughter and I went to Barmouth in Wales for a holiday, after a couple of days I said to them, or I said to my wife, because the little girl was very small in those days, I said, "Have you had enough here? Shall we move on to Aberystwyth?" So she said, "Yes, I don't mind." When we got there, I said, "Will you take Isabel onto the beach? There's a fellow up at the university that I want to see." And so I went and introduced myself to Ken Edwards, who was the technician in the physics department. He'd noticed the difference in the radio signals in a different respect from us. He'd noticed that the signals ceased abruptly as it went into the Earth's shadow, and reappeared abruptly as the satellite emerged from eclipse. So we pulled our data, and we published our first paper as Perry, Slater and Edwards in Spaceflight, the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society.
Thank you.
stage was when we had a suggestion from the Radio and Space Research Station that we ought to listen to the signals from the satellites, which disappeared from orbit after only a few days, long before they would have decayed naturally. And the transmission frequencies for these were announced by the Russians as about 19.995 megahertz. So we started to pick up signals from these short-lived satellites, which eventually came to be called eight-day wonders, because most of them were recovered on the eighth day. This was the basis of our early work, studying these signals. We never thought we would understand what these signals meant. So, of course, was when the satellites were transmitting. And there was a note in Flight International to the effect that Cosmos 32 had decayed on a particular date, plus or minus 12 hours. Well, plus or minus 12 hours really meant it was saying it came down on Tuesday or came down on Wednesday, and we knew we could do better than that because we'd actually had signals from it. By this time, the girls from Kettering High School, who were coming to the school to do physics, were actually making observations because they were using my laboratory to sit in at times when they weren't being taught. And one day, as I'd gone out to teach, I'd said, if that thing makes a noise, just note the time from the clock on the blackboard. So we wrote a letter to the editor of Flight International and signed it Barbara Jakes, G.E. Perry and J.D. Slater in alphabetical order. And she got a letter back saying, Dear Miss Jakes, you and your pupils. So we put that right, and eventually it led to Ken Owen coming to the school and doing a two-page article on Kettering's Cosmos Scholars in the space issue of Flight International the following year. I think it was in 1964 that the girls finally got a physics teacher of their own, and I lost my slave labour. So to take the place of the girls, I invited selected boys to help me with my hobby. One in particular was David Sinnott, who lived next door to me at home, and on one occasion he was entrusted with the keys to the school at the weekend to cycle up and do an observation and bring the keys back. In January 1966, I received a tape recording from Sweden from an 18-year-old Swedish student called Sven Gran, saying, I have been trying to receive satellite signals for 1.5 years. Today when I came home, my father told me the Russians had launched Cosmos 104. I immediately tuned in my receiver, and 1.5 hours later, I recorded these signals. I think you are the person who is most likely to tell me if these are from Cosmos 104. Notice that he said the person who was most likely, not the person who was best able. And I thought, poor devil, he's been trying for 1.5 years, and not only that, when he comes home, he's had to wait 1.5 hours, which is a whole orbital period. He must have just missed it before he came in. So I wrote back to him and said, yes, these are indeed signals from Sputnik, from Cosmos 104. There's another one up that, like that at the moment. We expect it to be recovered on, say, Thursday. If you care to send me the results of your observations, I will send them with mine to the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough. And this was the start of the first overseas member of the Kettering Group, and Sven has worked with us from that day to this. He's currently the head of advanced projects of the Swedish Space Corporation. He was the project manager for the satellite Viking, which was launched on Ariane early in 1986, and is currently project manager for the Nordic communication satellite Tele-X. In the meantime, he's been to China on several occasions and has signed a $1 million contract with the Chinese for the launch of a Swedish satellite Mailstar on a Long March 2. So I followed Sven's progress with considerable interest from that day right to now. A little later, he sent a letter to me saying, "After a Cosmos was recovered, I received a Morse code transmission." And I read the letter with interest and thought, well, poor lad, he doesn't really know the difference between a satellite and Morse code, and thought nothing more about it. Then, 2 or 3 months later, we had a parent of one of the boys came in early one morning to hear the Cosmos on its last orbit before recovery, and after the signals had stopped abruptly as the instrument package had burned up, we got talking, and I went to the blackboard to explain something to Mr. Manning, and all of a sudden I heard a signal. I immediately realised that this was the Morse code transmission that Sven had written about earlier, and quickly went home, got his letter out of the file, checked and found that it was exactly what he'd had, and these dots and dashes, which you will recognise as the Morse code letter T, the dash, and da-di-da, dash, dot, dash, K, this sequence of TKs were obviously from the recovery beacon of the capsule as it descended on its parachute over Kazakhstan. The interesting thing about this is that the dash in the T is twice as long as the dash in the K. Since then we've had recovery beacons of TLs, TGs, TFs, even TVs. And it's interesting that T is the common letter, and it was very fortunate that we started calling these TKs rather than KTs. Later that year we noticed that on the last transmitting pass of the day, as the satellite was leaving the range of the Soviet Union, the transmission was switched off, switched on, switched off, switched on, switched off, and switched on. There was a definite switching sequence, which was obviously something to do with programming it for restarting on the following day. So in the space of about 12 months, we'd come to identify distinct features of these satellites. First of all, we knew when the satellite was being recovered. We could tell how good the recovery was from the length of time that the TK recovery beacon lasted after it hit the ground and the signal strength dropped. And we identified the switching sequence at the end of the last transmitting pass of the day. Also, in 1966, we noticed that the signals from Cosmos 112, launched on the 17th of March, were different. They sounded throaty, as if it wanted to clear its throat, and we only got half of the Doppler shift. The only way you get half of the Doppler shift is when the satellite is commanded on when it is overhead at your station, and you get the second half as the satellite moves away. It was obvious that this satellite, Cosmos 112, was being commanded from a station in the north of Russia rather than from the usual part in the Soviet Union. After a couple of days and looking at the orbital traces that the satellite had made, it was obvious that it had not come from the usual launch site at Tar-Yur-Atam, or what the Russians call Baikonur, but had come from considerably further west, and plotting the track we noticed that it did pass over the island of Novaya Zemlya up in the Arctic. And because the Russians had used Novaya Zemlya for atomic weapons tests, we speculated in the letter to Flight International, saying first of all the Russians were using a new launch site, and secondly that it might prove to be on Novaya Zemlya. The trouble with one line is that it could have been anywhere from the toe of Italy up to Novaya Zemlya. We had to wait. We had two more satellites on very similar inclinations, and then in September we had Cosmos 129. This was at a different inclination from the usual one of 65 degrees. And the first reaction was, poor old Russians, they haven't quite made 65 degrees this time. We were running a computer prediction program on an Elliott 1402 computer at the Shoe and Allied Trades Research Association in Kettering. I used to phone the numbers through to Ron Smith in the morning and cycle up and collect the output at night. And I found that the rev numbers that I was getting differed by 3 from those which the Americans were providing. That didn't worry me unduly at first, because although American orbital data is very good in terms of position and time, they don't pay too much attention to the rev numbers. In fact, if you go by American rev numbers, you'd believe occasionally that the Russians launched satellites from Texas. However, after 2 or 3 days, our rev numbers were still 3 more than the American numbers, and I thought that perhaps, just possibly, we might be wrong and they might be right. That being the case, if our numbers were 3 too many, it meant that the satellite had made 3 fewer orbits. In 16 orbits, the Earth rotates approximately 22.5 degrees. 3 times 22.5 is 67.5 degrees, so we've got to move our ground track 67.5 degrees over to the west. In doing this, we found we had a track which crossed our earlier line 200 miles south of the Russian town of Archangel, near the village of Plesetsk. We didn't announce this immediately. I waited for a meeting of the British Interplanetary Society, where I was lecturing on the reconnaissance aspects of these satellites, followed it up with a letter to Flight International. Once again, not many people took any notice and produced no comment, except for a man called Dr. Charles Sheldon, who was head of Science Policy Research Division of the US Library of Congress. He badly wanted to write about Plesetsk in a report that he was writing on the Soviet space programs, but was unable to do so because, as far as the Americans were concerned, this was classified knowledge. So he drew the attention of the correspondent of the Washington Post to what we'd been writing in Flight International. And just after the school broke up for the Christmas holidays at the end of 1966, the full weight of the world's media descended upon us, with stories in the Washington Post: schoolboys detect Russian launch site using a 10-pound radio. We were still using the Marconi CR-100, which Derek Slater had actually paid £25 for from a friend who'd got it as ex-army surplus. The receiver probably had a value of about £400. The £25 that Derek paid got misinterpreted into $25 and then converted into pounds, and that was the origin of the £10 wireless. As time went by, I began to realise that as these satellites were being recovered, the transmitter was always on when it came over our horizon. And to check this, I needed someone around the other side of the world to listen to see if this was in fact the case. I realised that my father's cousin's daughter's son was seconded by the post office to Fiji. In more than one way, he was a very distant relation. And what is more, he had a radio with him. And so I wrote to him saying, "Dear Chris, how would you like to help me with our satellite work?" And before he could reply, I sent him a telegram telling him when to listen. His first observations actually confirmed that these satellites were transmitting over Fiji on the recovery pass. And very interestingly, with the Cosmos 199 recovery, it transmitted as it went over Fiji and didn't actually get out of orbit. It was still transmitting on the next pass. The orbital period dropped, but not sufficiently to throw it out of orbit. Chris was the second of our overseas members. In Fiji, Chris had entered into this with great aplomb and had made use of the equipment of the Fiji Post Office using a Morse inker, which produced blobs on 1 centimetre wide paper tape every time the satellite bleeped. And I made inquiries of our post office in England if they had a similar piece of equipment, and they loaned me on indefinite loan from their museum a Great Northern Telegraph Company Limited undulator Mark II, which must have gone back to the very earliest days of wireless telegraphy, which produced goalpost-like squares on the paper tape as the pen drew the trace out. Until this time, at the beginning of 1969,
We had no hope whatever of understanding what the bleeps meant. But the pen recorder opened a new dimension for us. Here was a chance to look at these bleeps. And the first thing that became apparent was that the first bleep after the brrrr, which was a synchronizing train of pulses, had variable lengths. It was either long or medium. We called the medium mode 1 and the long mode 2, because that's the way in which we discovered them. And then we noticed that on the recovery rev, the long word shortened to medium, and the medium word shortened to short. So here was a change in the telemetry which we were able to observe and correlate with the fact that the recovery capsule had been detached. Later we were able to show that one of the other words in the telemetry frame, a telemetry frame consisted of 15 bleeps or 15 words, we were able to show with the help of Dick Flagg, the University of Florida, who'd also joined the group as an overseas member, that the lengths of these words were equivalent to numerical values. Such telemetry is called pulse duration modulation, and in fact these were logarithmically amplified before quantization, so that a small value produced a measurable pulse, and it reduced the risk of overrunning at the far end for a very high value. We were able to identify one of the pulses as the exposure counter on the photographic camera taking film on these photographic reconnaissance missions. Well, initially we recognised that it was a measure of some consumable. Now, what does a photographic reconnaissance satellite consume? Well, it consumes film. It could also consume fuel for attitude stabilisation, control gas. We weren't able to resolve this problem until the Bangladesh Indo-Pakistani war, when we had two satellites which flew short missions of 4 and 5 days instead of the usual 8, and in fact they used all of their consumable in that short mission. So obviously they were using film, because for attitude stabilisation they would have only used half the ordinary amount. We were able also to move from this interpretation of PDM from the 8-day recoverable Cosmos to fit it into the Soyuz program of manned spaceflight. In the following year, we had the receiver mushing quietly away in the back of the physics lab during sixth form practical lesson, when we picked up some irregular signals which sounded something like Vostok, but not quite the same. I sent a lad rushing up to Derek Slater in the chemistry lab to ask him to come down and listen, and he agreed with me that they were man-type signals rather than unmanned. We waited until the mid-morning break, phoned the Radio and Space Research Station and said we thought we'd had signals from a new manned spacecraft. They suggested that they came from Electron 1. I said, no, Electron 1 doesn't transmit on that frequency. And they suggested it was from a Cosmos. They said, no, that was recovered last week. And I put the phone down as I was paying. But before I'd got out of earshot of the school office, I was called back, and there was a phone call from the Kettering Evening Telegraph with Dick Pankhurst saying that the Russians had launched a 3-man spacecraft called Voskhod 1 and gave us the transmission frequencies.
I believe you have a recording of the Voskhod 1 telemetry.
The Voskhod program is generally believed to have been a way to upstage the Americans. Germany was on the drawing boards to fly 2 men, so Voskhod had to have 3. And then in the Germany program it was being announced that eventually astronauts would do spacewalks or go EVA. So when Voskhod 2 was launched, this was obviously to be a Russian EVA before the first Germany flight. We heard the Voskhod signals, and the following day we heard them as the signals ceased and expected the thing to be recovered. This was one orbit more than we had expected. At 9 o'clock in the morning, Radio Moscow said, "Stand by for an important announcement," and started to play jolly Russian music. At 9:30, it said, "Stand by for an important announcement." And as the morning went on, the music got more and more mournful. We had the first movement of Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto, and then we had it again, and there was still no sound or no announcement of any recovery. And finally, the recovery wasn't announced until about 1:45 in the afternoon, when they said that they had recovered their cosmonauts safe and sound. But even this proved not to be true. They'd got them down, but these poor fellows had to stay in their capsule overnight, without any heat, in a wood, with wolves howling all around them. They'd come down well away from the planned recovery area. There was a second generation of reconnaissance Cosmos satellites. And at first we couldn't pick up the signals. I remember this quite vividly. Frequency was quite different. It was 19.150 megahertz, which the Russians announced. We tried those frequencies and got nothing. On the second occasion, I noted in the log interference from a strong Morse code transmission. When the third one went, again we noticed Morse code, and we tried to tune the Morse code out. Had no success, but we left the receiver on, and I was setting out apparatus for a practical physics examination for the General Certificate of Education. And suddenly this Morse code transmission appeared, and I cursed about it, but because I was in the middle of doing a job, I didn't go and touch the receiver, and I suddenly realised there was a Doppler shift on this Morse code. And what we'd been tuning out were the signals from this satellite, and the transmission that we were supposed to be getting actually was the Morse code. When we listened to the Morse code more carefully, we could see that the characters were broken into groups of three, and these three were things like STS or MOM, which, when you added up the dots and dashes, always gave you groups of seven. Now, more than that, one like STS was a 3-1-3 group, did-da-da-da-da-da-da, whereas the others like MOM were did-da-da-da-da-da, 2-3-2s. And we had 11 2-3-2s between each of the 3-1-3s. So here was obviously a 12-word telemetry frame, the start of which was signified by the 313 group, and the next 11 by the following groups. It seemed obvious that this would be a digital code with a naught and a 1 for a dash and a dot, or the other way around. But when we substituted noughts and ones, we got a string of numbers which didn't make much sense. This was from the seventh of the words, which changed from orbit to orbit, and sometimes changed actually during a particular pass. And it was clear that this would eventually prove to be the key to cracking that code. One day I said to David Muggleton, one of the lads who was in the second of the two dinner sittings, I said, "Look, David, write out all the groups for word 7 through that flight of that last cosmos, and then put the ones and the noughts in, ones for dashes, noughts for dots." And just before the bell went for dinner, I walked up to the back of the lab and looked at him across the bench, and I could see, upside down, that this was a binary code, but instead of reading it from left to right in the conventional way, the Russians were reading it from right to left. They were transmitting the least significant bit first. And as soon as we started to decode it that way, we could see that we had a steady progression in word 7, which turned out to be the exposure counter for the reconnaissance camera. We could also see, when word 6 changed from MWI to MRI, that a capsule had been ejected prior to recovery, And that night, having seen the change in the telemetry, we could make visual observations and see two objects. Instead of the satellite on its own, there was a satellite preceded by a fainter piece, which was the manoeuvring engine. A third generation of Cosmos satellite, for reconnaissance purposes, broadcasts a simple two-tone frequency shift keyed signal like this. To date, we've not been able to determine any information on this signal. All we can say is that the cycle duration for one complete up and down note varies from satellite to satellite, and this does provide a means of distinguishing between two satellites when two of the same kind are in orbit. For instance, you can have one satellite with a cycle duration of 1.72 seconds and another one with a cycle duration of 1.53 seconds. Worse was to follow. A fourth generation appeared which didn't transmit any shortwave signals at all. However, we were able to pick up signals with Sven Gran in Stockholm up in the VHF range, so we were able then to positively identify the fourth generation satellites. But the story doesn't have a happy ending. The Russians now have a fifth generation satellite which do not transmit signals on shortwave, nor do they transmit signals on any VHF frequency that we can find, and at last we feel that they have a satellite up that we can't listen to. But at least we know that it's a reconnaissance satellite from its orbital characteristics and the way it manoeuvres. Our big problem is going to come when they have a sixth generation satellite and we're not going to be able to tell the difference between generation 5 and generation 6. But then I might not be here then.